I hope you are not too exhausted or stuffed with quantum field theory. So today, I plan to continue the discussion and speak a bit about the physics of non-abelian gauge theories, because we have been doing a lot of math, but I'm still doing some math. And I was hoping to be able to have time to discuss of the Higgs mechanism, but that doesn't really make sense because there are still things to explain on non-abelian gauge theories. So yesterday I discussed in a very, very sketchy way the problem of renormalization of gauge theories, because I showed you, I hope I convinced you, even if we didn't did any calculation, that by power counting, a gauge theory has ultraviolet divergence, exactly as the 5-4 theory, and therefore it has to be, renormalization has to be introduced, and this has been a problem which is non-trivial and which has solved. It takes about 20 years for the problem, or at least 15 years, to be understood and solved. So let me remind first what we are considering: the Young-Mills theory. So it was based on the SU2 gauge group, but this can be extended easily. And so now what we have? We have a well-defined quantization, well, at least sensible quantization, received by functional integral, which is expected to work, where we start from the classical action, which is the Young-Mills action. Then we had, and then we have a gauge fixing term. So the Young-Mills action is more or less 1/4 or 2 g squared. I never remember the normalization, which depends a bit on the normalization. It's 2 g squared of integral d4x of trace of f mu nu. This is the usual Maxwell term, except that now f mu nu, so we have a gauge field A, which is a collection of f a mu I of x, where a 1, 2, 3 are the group indices, and mu are the usual Lorentz indices, and this belongs to the adjoint representation of the group G. And f mu nu is defined as d mu a nu minus d nu a mu. And then there is a plus or minus, I never remember. I remember minus I, the commutator of a mu and a nu. And now the gauge connection do not commute because they are matrices. Okay. So this is a standard Young-Mills action. The gauge fixing term, we have seen that it can be written as by introducing fermions, and by introducing ghost fields, which involves ghost fields. And basically, if I am using the Landau gauge, the gauge field condition is just integral d4x c bar, a differential operator which is the ordinary derivative applied to the covariant derivative of the ghost fields. So we have C, which is the collection of CA, which is a ghost field. C bar, which is a collection of C bar A, which is the anti-ghost
field, they also live in the hadron representative of G, but they do not carry any Lorentz indices, so these are spin one. And these are spin zero field, but these are scalar or bosons, vectors, and these are fermions, because this term is here in the action in order to represent the Fadeev Popov determinant. Okay, so we have this, and in addition to this, we have, and then we have to, a bit of choice about factor, but we have the gauge fixing term, which for the remember the gauge, the Lorentz gauge means d mu a mu equals zero. Okay, so in order to enforce this constraint, we can add a Lagrange multiplier, an auxiliary field, which when you integrate in the action is, so B is a Lagrange multiplier which enforces the constraint that d mu a mu equals zero. Okay? Which is a Landau Lorentz Landau gauge. Okay. So if we now take as a total action which involves both A, C, C bar, and B, this defines a well-defined passing goal quantization, and we can derive out of this sensible Feynman diagrammatic rules, because since we have fixed the gauge, the propagator is now well-defined. So now we have our path integral, which is integral over dA, integral over the Gauss field, integral over dB of exponential of I times this action, the total action. Okay. And out of this, we get attribution theory with a well-defined propagator. Okay. Well, in the following, I'm going to discuss what's happening when you add matter. So I will briefly discuss that, but if we add, for instance, Dirac fields, I'm going to add a Dirac field psi, it leads to, in the fundamental representation of the field. So in fact, this is a collection of psi alpha I, and same for psi bar alpha I, where I goes from 1 to 2, because this belongs to the fundamental representation. And alpha, that goes from 1 to 4, are the standard Dirac indices. And then the action, so the Lagrangian, for the Dirac field is just, so let's say S Dirac is the standard action for a Dirac particle, a spinor in an external electromagnetic field. So it's going to be psi bar I d slash minus m psi, where the only difference is now that d slash, this is the covariant derivative, so d slash is gamma mu d mu. hence this is gamma mu d mu plus I a mu. Well, this is a Dirac matrix, usual Dirac matrix. And now this is the ordinary derivative plus I times the electromagnetic potential. And here this is a mu and not the commutator because the field lives in the fundamental representation. Okay, so this is exactly like for QED, except that now this is a matrix because psi has I components. But you get the same kind of exactly the same kind of interaction vertex, where here the electromagnetic field carries a Lorentz indices because it's a spinor, it's a vector, and a group indices because it belongs to the adjoint. The Dirac field carries a group index, but of the fundamental representation and the Dirac indices, and you have a vertex that contains, in addition to the standard gamma mu term, it contains a T mu, I'm sorry, a T A IG coefficient. This is the IG element of the generator, of the A generator of the group. A are the generators of the group. In QED, this term is one. There is no index here, there is no index here, so this term is just one. Okay. Okay. So, I just stated at the end of the last lecture that it was proven in the 70s that gauge theories are renormalizable. This means that, oh, and of course, yeah, this means that all the ultraviolet divergence that are contained at one loop and then at any loop in the gauge theory can be reabsorbed in a renormalization of the coupling of the theory, the parameter of the theory. And the parameters in the theory, there is only one coupling for the gauge boson. And if you add the fermions, the only parameter left is the mass. So this means that you can add counter terms to G, the charge or the coupling constant. You had some field renormalization in a consistent way. And here the fields are A mu, the C bar, and the fermions. And that's it. Okay. So it works like pi to the four. So I'm not going to do the calculation. You can find the detail of the calculation of renormalization at one loop for the pure Young-Mills in a textbook, for instance, in the book by Peskin and Schroeder, sorry. But it will take the whole lecture, and it's a bit technical. So I just want to discuss the meaning of the result. But let me stress two things. You have several methods to do the calculation, like we did in 5^4. And the original method by Toft and Veltman was to use what's called dimensional regularization. But I think you have seen in tutorials or in homeworks, and you have seen it in a statistical mechanics course, which consists to go from d equals 4 dimension to d equals 4 minus epsilon, or plus epsilon if you want, so that the ultraviolet divergence becomes poles in 1 over epsilon, and you add counter terms in order to subtract the pole. So it's a mathematical method which seems a bit mysterious, but which works very well. And it works very well in gauge theories, because this dimensional regularization do not spoil gauge invariants. If you use standard regularization, like adding masses, making the propagator, modifying the propagator, like a Polyvilla regularization, has problem with gauge invariants. But there is another way to do the calculation. So this method to do the calculation is just to write the Feynman diagrams and isolate the divergence and renormalize. So that's the standard. That's exactly like that what we did in 5^4 theory, except that there are more diagrams. There is a related method which is closer to what we did when we discussed the relation with Wilson normalization, which consists in computing the effective action at least this is easy at one loop. Remember, in phi-4 theory, we have defined an object which is the effective action in a background field. And you can define exactly by the same method the effective action of a gauge field in a background classical field. So this is going to be the standard Young-Mills action, mu background, let's write it background. Okay, and then it's going to be 1/2 of trace log of the second derivative of this Young-Mills action. That's a one loop result. And there is going to be an H bar in front of that. That's one loop. But because of gauge invariance, if you just compute this naively, this has zero mode. So the log is infinite because you have logs of zeros. So you have to gauge fixing, gauge fix. And in this case, since you are computing substance in a background field, it means that when you compute this trace log, better to use. So it means that basically in the calculation you write that a mu is a mu background plus some quantum fluctuations. If you remember what we did last week when computing at one loop the effective action, this one loop terms come from the fact that we integrate over the fluctuation the field around a classical configuration. And so we have to use the gauge fixing so that we keep into account the quantum fluctuation that correspond to different physical. And so we have to subtract to those fluctuations, the fluctuations which are just gauge transformation. And a convenient gauge fixing is what is called the background you want lambda or gauge, which is that you assume that d mu in the background field of A mu, hence A mu tilde, is equal to zero, where D mu background is just the ordinary derivative minus I times the commutator of A mu background with the object that you take the derivative. So you see, so instead of taking the covariant derivative with respect to A itself, you take the covariant derivative with respect to A background, and you let A tilde fluctuate. So it's just a generalization of the usual Landau gauge, because the usual Landau gauge consists in this background gauge fixing in the trivial A equals zero. Okay. Just generalization of Landau. Okay. So both this calculation and this calculation, you can find the details, for instance, in the book by Peskin, but this one is slightly more easier, but still it's I don't have the time to discuss it. So but the moral is that when you compute this term, you find, for instance, the pole in 1 over epsilon, which is proportional to the Young-Mead axon itself. Therefore, it can be incorporated in a renormalization of G. Yeah. So I don't give no calculation here. Because what I want to do is discuss the result. Okay. So, because that's the result which is important. Well, the detail are of course important, but so the result is that the most important property is that so you can renormalize. So you can consider that there is a renormalized coupling constant which is a bare coupling constant plus some counter term which is of order g squared with some coefficient and, for instance, a 1 over epsilon pole, etc. Okay. And the important thing is the sign of this coefficient. Because in the same way than we did in phi to the 4, or you did in QED, you can extract a renormalization group beta function for this coupling, which is just the, because since we have poles or logarithm of epsilon, we must introduce the renormalization group scale, and the effective coupling constant depends on the scale, energy scale. That's exactly the same phenomenon. But the final result is that when you compute the beta function for G, in fact, the coupling is G squared. The beta function for G turns out to be G cube. It's G cube because the real coupling beta function is alpha equal G squared. So, and then there is a coefficient which is negative. So you find the 1 over 4 pi squared, which is the usual coefficient we had. And we get a coefficient which turns out to be, so let me just write it. This is something I took in the book. There is some coefficient which turns out to be this. That's come from the contribution of the Gauss, etc. And then you have a coefficient which I am going to call C2. And if you add Dirac fermions, some other coefficient, Cf, let's say. So C2 depends on the group. And for SU2, it is 1. For the group SUN, no, I'm sorry, it's 2. For SUN, it's N. And in general, for a general group, it's the invariant of the group called the second Casimir of the group. General second Casimir of G. That's the group theory. And the important thing is this minus sign. And NF is just the number of families of fermions. Okay. So if you have a renormalization that which comes just from the number of loops of fermions inside the propagator of the gauge field, this term is a term of QED. So if you have one species of fermions, you have get one loop. If you have two species of fermions, you have contribution of two different kinds of loops, and they add up. So this term is natural. And CF depends also of the group. It depends on the representation in which the matter fields lives. The fermions, here they live in the fundamental representation. And this is one half for SU2, if the matter lives in the fundamental representation. Okay, for our case, where we have one family of fermion and and n equal 2, we get minus 11 divided by 3 times 2 plus 4/3. Okay. But the important point is this one, this term. Minus sign. Okay. And so this is the beta function for G. And if you are a bit unfamiliar with G cube, you can just think that if you write the beta function for alpha of alpha, where alpha is G squared, you get an alpha squared 1 over 4 pi squared. And here you are getting, you get a factor, which I think is 2, because this is, you get factor 2 times the same coefficient. Okay. So this is the famous results which are first obtained, in fact, by Toft. And then reobtained a few years later, well, 1 year later, and insisted to physics by Gross and Wilczek and Politzer for SU3 and for strong interaction. Toft was more interested in the electroweak interaction. And this, well, those gentlemen got the Nobel Prize for this calculation. Toft got the Nobel Prize for another related thing. Okay. And this is one of the most important achievements of quantum field theory, the discovery that the sign is negative. Okay. But what does it mean? I think I discussed this a little bit last week, but this basically means that gauge theory has a property called asymptotic freedom. Asymptotic freedom meets at high energies. Because remember, the beta function, for instance, alpha, is defined by how, as a function of the energy, goes the effective coupling constant as a function of the energy defined as we did for phi to the 4. And if the beta function is negative, it means that at high energy, the variation of alpha is negative. So this flows to 0. So to have a beta function as a function of alpha, which is like this, instead of going up, like in the QED of phi to the 4, means that as a function of energy, you flow here as the energy increase. So this is, let's say, ultraviolet, write it in blue, and you flow to large coupling as the energy decrease. So this is just ultraviolet limit and the infrared limit. So this means that in the gauge theory, because of the radiative correction, the effective charge of the gauge boson, or the coupling between the gauge boson and the fermions, decreases at high energy. So the theory at high energy interactions becomes negligible. And we can treat the theory as if it was a free theory, neglecting the radiative correction, the loops. And we have, in some sense, a free gas. Gauge boson, namely the so-called gluons, and of fermions, which in strong interaction for SU3 are going to correspond to the quarks. Okay. And this has been very important because this explained the results of the experiments that took place at the beginning of the 70s. And which explains that if you have a hadron, for instance, a proton, inside the hadron, you have free quarks and free gluons that can be at very high energy when you look very closely, so at high energy inside the hadron, the proton, for instance, behaves as if there was just a free gas. And this motivator, in fact, this was explained, was a phenomenological model that has been introduced before to explain the experiments, which was a parton model, which was said that inside the hadron, you had elementary particles, called denoted parton, which behave like free particles in a bag. The partons are, in fact, the excitation of the fields of the gauge and Dirac field, quarks field, inside the hadron, which behave at very high energy as independent partons. Okay, that's a very crude description of what's going on. But so all this effect comes from the fact that the beta function is negative. Okay. So now, of course, the consequence of that is that on the other side, at low energy or at large distance, The theory is strongly coupled.
At large distance. It means that in particular, this explains the, well, this is compatible with the existence of hadron. If you go to larger scale, the effective coupling increases, and the gluon, the gauge bosons, and the fermions, the quarks, start to interact very strongly. And they interact in a very non-trivial way, because at the difference with QED, the gauge bosons interact. They are charged. So another way to view this is that in QED, where there is asymptotic slavery at high energy, asymptotic freedom at low energy, the fact that the effective charge decreases at large distance, beta of alpha equal plus alpha squared, so that alpha of E decreases when E goes to zero, is described in a very classical way by a screening effect. It's that if you have a big charge, it's a charge plus, and you are trying to see what is the measure of the charge at infinity by making some experiment, because of quantum effect, you have virtual pairs of electrons and positons that lives in the vacuum because of the quantum fluctuation. It's a crude picture, but what's going on? And if you have a particle, that's an effect very well known in molecular physics. It's called Debye screening. When you have a charge on plus and minus particles around a charge, if the charge is plus, the minus particles are attracted toward plus, while the plus particles are repelled. So on the average, there is a cloud negatively charged around the positive charge, which induce screening. Okay. So there is a screening effect. In Young-Mills theory, like QCD, QCD is just the SU3 non-abelian gauge theory, the fact that the beta function is negative means that there is an anti-screening effect. So this anti-screening effect is less easy to describe than the screening effect is QED, where you just have pairs of electron and positon, and the photons don't play any role in this virtual, you do not create. But you can find in the book by Peskin and Schroer, a description of this anti-screening effect that, in fact, they quote some other physicists, which have a way which is semi-quantitative a description of this effect, which consists to say that if you have a quark with some charge here, and if you have you can create pairs of gauge bosons. You can have a gauge bosons and an anti-gauge bosons with opposite colors. But remember, the colors now are multi-indices. But
So if you have some, let's say some electric charge, you have a charge which can create an opposite electric field, but the electric field interacts with this one because now you have a coupling between the electric and magnetic field. And it creates a magnetic field which by back reaction modifies the position of the possible, so there is some kind of back reaction effect by interaction between E's and B's, electric and magnetic fields, this non-abelian electric magnetic fields. So this is a non-linear effect. And if you do the calculation, you can convince ourselves that in fact the effect, instead of saying that you have a counter electric field that is created by screening, means that you have an effective field is because of nonlinear effects goes in the same direction. So the charge increases, the effective charge increases with the distance, which means anti-screening. The quantum fluctuation increases the electric field created by the charged particle. Okay. So I'm not going to describe that. I think last year I convinced myself that how this works, but I won't have time. But it's quite neatly explained in the book by Peskin. Okay. So, you may ask yourself, if the effective coupling grows at a large distance, it might cause a problem of Gauss and like in quantum electrodynamics, where you have that following Landau and other physicists, this is problematic for phi to the four. Because by the same argument, you find that there is some energy scale E such that infrared. Such that if you just integrate the renormalization group flow equation like this, you find that alpha effective at this energy, infrared energy scale, goes to infinity. So the coupling becomes ultra strong. Okay. So is it a problem? In fact, it is not a problem, but it's in some sense a solution, because well, it doesn't explain much things, but it tells you that if you start at a renormalization energy, let's say mu naught, this is going to be the energy at which we defined our renormalized coupling, alpha. Alpha is a g squared here. Let's say alpha zero. Then this, let's say, infrared energy scale, you found that just by integrating the equation of motion, so is given by mu, not your energy scale. And then you have something which is of the form exponential of minus, you have a coefficient which is related to the coefficient of the beta function. And where is it written here? It's not written. Okay, so you have some positive coefficient, C, divided by alpha. No, plus. No, it's minus. it's written in my normalization calculation. Okay. So this means that, no, it's plus.
Right.
Because the smaller alpha, the larger this energy scale is. So it means that this energy scale here, at which the physics becomes fully non-perturbative, cannot be seen at any order in perturbation theory. It's infinite at any order in perturbation theory. You see? Oh, no, it's, no, I'm sorry, it's minus because I'm mixing distances and energy. Yeah. If you go to small energies, I'm sorry, I'm not very well awake. Well, let's do the calculation again in this case. I write E d over dE of alpha equal minus some coefficient alpha squared, which means that d over d of 1 over alpha equal minus c dE over E, which means that that's what this is. So this means that 1 over alpha minus 1 over alpha 0 equal minus c log of E divided by mu 0, because mu 0 is where we start from, and therefore E equal mu 0 exponential of minus 1 over alpha. When alpha becomes infinite, you get minus 1 over alpha 0. Alpha 0 is a coupling alpha 0. So you get that this is exponential of minus, no, that's plus, sorry, c, 1 over c,
I think you need a minus sign.
Pardon?
The d 1 over alpha already has the minus sign.
Where?
I don't think there is a minus sign at the bottom left. The d1 over alpha already contains the minus sign.
Oh, yes, of course. No, I'm sorry. Yeah, of course. Okay, so you get minus. Yeah, wow. It's time for me to take some. Okay, so you get this. So you see that this energy scale is invisible in perturbation theory. So you have an onset of non-perturbative physics. And for instance, one onset of non-perturbative physics is that you create hadrons, so bound state of gauge bosons, quarks, which have an energy scale of the order of E infrared. In some sense, typically you expect that the mass of the bound state of the theory is proportional. There is some number that has to be calculated to this energy scale. Okay. So that's a very crude argument. And the coefficient computing the mass of the hadrons in a non-abelian gauge theory is simple, like pure SU3, for instance, well done. In terms of the coupling constants, is something which can be achieved only by non-perturbative method. exact calculation of the spectrum. Young Mills series has to be achieved by non-perturbative methods. So perturbation theory is a very powerful tool to study the high energy regime of the H series, but it's a very poor method to look at the what comes out at low energy out of it. H theory. Okay. So in particular, non-Abelian gauge theories are expected to exhibit a very important phenomenon, which is differs from QED, which is the phenomenon of confinement. I'm sure you have heard about confinement. Confinement means that we expect, and in some cases one can prove, that no, let's say, non-color singlets, which means in some sense neutral particles, bound state, can be observed, which means or constructed as asymptotic states of the theory. Well, no isolated quarks or isolated gluon has never been observed in a high energy physics experiment. You can observe the outcome of a reaction, a collision, where some isolated pattern has been emitted in the collision. It can be very energetic. It can stay, in some sense, you can consider it as a particle isolated in the vacuum. But after some time, it gets dressed by quarks, anti-quarks, and it ends up in forming a jet of what's called a jet of color singlets particles like electrons and mesons. Okay, so just if you make a very strong particles, you can emit, for instance, a gluon. But after some points, it becomes a jet, and that's what you observe. Okay, so this phenomenon of confinement is something that still, eludes some of the. Well, it's now much better understood than when gauge theories were found to be asymptotically free. But for a mathematical physicist or for a mathematician, confinement is still a conjecture. There is no proof that confinement really exists in non-Abelian gauge theories, and even the mathematician have. Even, or at least the mathematician, have convinced some Russian billionaire to promise $1 billion if you can prove confinement. That's one of those famous Milner Prize. But that's not, of course, it's not a criteria whether this is important. Yes?
Can you explain please why confinement is kind of implied, but what was just so?
No, it's not implied. That's the point. The point is that this is the example of confinement. But the confinement is a non-perturbative phenomenon that physicists on physical and experimental ground we expect to be true, and we are most of us convinced that this takes place in ordinary gauge theories. But the fact that the beta function is negative is not a proof of confinement. It just tells you that if confinement occurs, it occurs at an energy scale given by this kind of formula. So it's compatible with confinement.
Okay. Oh, so it's more confinement is more an observation than.
Yeah, it's an observation, but okay, there are theoretical, strong theoretical reason and calculation which show that there is confinement, but it's not No perturbative calculation can give you a proof of confinement for the reason that I explained. Because confinement will occur at a scale which is invisible at any order of perturbation theory. So you can start to play with perturbation theory, resum it, but in order to get some interesting physics at the scale of confinement, in fact, you can start from perturbation theory, but add some non-perturbative input. So there is a whole, a whole school and a whole industry, which is called QCD sum rules. Which is associated to the initial SVZ, because it was started, this game was started by Russian physicists, the Schiffman, Weinstein, and one Zakharov, I think, but maybe not the famous one. I think at least Schiffman is now in the US. He's in Minnesota or something like that. And basically the idea is to add to perturbation theory, well, the ordinary perturbation theory with Feynman diagrams, terms, proportional to non-perturbative vacuum expectation value of operators. Okay. Because for instance, consider the operator that appears in the action. Consider the operator trace of f mu nu at a given point x in space. Okay? And okay. So it's like it's something which is somehow similar to in 5-4 theory, where this is expected to be zero, except that this is going to be different to zero if there is spontaneous symmetry breaking. So, in QCD, this operator has a dimension of a length to the power minus 4. Because remember, it's just the coefficient of the action, which integrated over space gives a dimensionless action. So this has the dimension of an energy to the 4. So the claim is that if you can make sense of this, of the vacuum expectation value of this operator, this, and if this is non-zero, this should be a signal of non-perturbative physics, and this should be proportional to this infrared energy given by this formula to the power 4. So if this is different from zero, then this is one of the signals of non-perturbative physics and you should add contribution proportional to these objects to perturbation theory. So this is to say that physical quantities, if you want, physical quantities, some physical quantities equal perturbation theory plus this trace of x squared, some things plus etc. Okay. And this object, if this is zero, this is denoted gluon condensate. It's a terminology of this approach. in the same way that this is going to call the spin condensate. In statistical physics. Okay. So, these are the example of how to take into account non-perturbative phenomenon in QCD. Okay. I won't say more about this approach first because I never really worked on that, so I'm not a specialist. And except that, in addition. There are a lot of subtle mathematical problems in order to define this. In order to define this, for instance, you need to consider with some perturbation theory. And I already claimed that for phi to the 4, perturbation theory is not convergent theory. So there are problems of resummation. Resummation techniques. This is related to a mathematical problem which is now important in many areas of physics and mathematical physics. So you might have heard the name already, but I think there has been some seminars or even some workshop going on here. It's called the theory of resurgence. So there is a lot of math involved in trying to make sense of this. Okay. So now let me just give a very short introduction to the physics of confinement and what it means. For this, it's better to say a word about lattice gauge theories. I would just introduce you to lattice gauge theories because that's an important tool that since the beginnings of gauge theories has been used to study the non-perturbative physics of gauge theories. In fact, how to formulate gauge theory on a lattice, namely on discretized space-time, this has been invented by Ken Wilson, the famous Ken Wilson, I think it was in 74. Mainly there was also this is from the condensed matter class, Carl Wegener, who had ideas, but in a more specific setting. So the idea of lattice gauge series is to construct a path integral for gauge series by discretizing space-time. So we are in an Euclidean setting. Well, you can do that Euclidean space-time. And for simplicity, let's take a lattice. I'm going to just to take a square lattice. Okay. And then can we define the functional integral? And can we compute? Okay. So we have seen that if you have an Euclidean lattice, for putting scalar field on a lattice is very simple. You just have a scalar field. So scalar field phi of x, it just lives on the vertices. So you have a phi of I, variable if I is a lattice. Okay.
For fermions, it's slightly more complicated, but this can be done too. The problem with the gauge field A mu of x, the gauge potential. Because mathematically, the gauge field is a connection that mathematicians call the connection. It's associated to line elements. And a connection tells you when you have some kind of geometrical object. It doesn't describe what's happening at a point. It describes how you move from one point to another one. Connection means connect two points. In other words, how to move. On the lattice. Okay? So in fact, it turns out that this was the idea of Wilson, that gauge fields do not live on the vertices, on the lattice. They live on the edges. E. Of the lattice, because that tells you how you move from a point I to a point G. Okay. But on the other hand, you need still to have gauge transformation. And gauge transformation, local gauge transformation, are described by elements of the group that are associated to points. So gauge transformation should be associated to the vertices. Okay? So here is a receipt. On each point of the lattice, sometimes you have some space on which the gauge group acts. And the gauge connection will tell you how to move from one of those spaces to one of those points, and you have to describe how you move from one of those points to one of those points in a covariant way when you perform an independent gauge transformation on each point. So here is a receipt of Wilson, and I don't have written notes here. So I try to. Well, I have some notes on my tablet. But so the idea is that now, to each oriented edge of the lattice, so I consider an edge which is IG. IG means that I'm going to from I to G. I associate an element B of E, which is an element of the group. Okay. So it tells you it's a transformation from there to there. Okay? Such that, of course, if I consider the inverse edge, let's say, which is GI, and I go from G to I, I associate G of E minus 1, which is just the inverse of G. So that if I go here and then I go back, I end up where I started from. Okay? So this is called, in fact, a connection on the lattice. So I constructed the G connection, let's say, a G connection. from the lattice. Okay? And now, so a gauge field configuration is going to correspond just to a data of all the connections on all the edge. How you move, how you transform, you act when you move. Okay. So this is the connection. This is going to be the gauge field. Okay. Now, of course, what these gauge fields is needed? It's needed if you have a scalar field and you want to compare the element of the scalar field between two points. Okay. So, in order, what this means? It means that we want to define what is a covariant derivative. What is a covariant derivative? Okay. So I consider that, let me consider just the case where you have a scalar field, phi, and it lives on the lattice. So it means that at each vertex of the lattice, I associate phi of I, which is the data, the value of the field, and this phi belongs to the fundamental representation. So for instance, for SU2, it's a two vector. And the G's are unitary matrices. For SU2, G belongs to SU2, and phi belongs to, is a two vector, belongs to R2. Okay. It's a space on which, E2. It's a space on which G acts. So it's a two-component complex vector. Okay. And now, given an edge E, which is IG, I want to define what is the covariant derivative of phi D in the direction E of phi. Covariant derivative of phi along the edge E. And that's an oriented edge. Okay. So if there were no gauge connection, this would be just phi of G minus phi of I. Okay? But now, I have a G that tells me how I carry on something from I to G. So here, in order to compare phi at point I and phi at point G, I have to carry on phi I to the vertex G, and then make the difference. So, carrying means that I multiply by G of E, phi of I. So this is the definition of a covariant derivative. You carry on phi from I to G, and then you compare it to phi G by measuring the difference. Okay? So this is just the definition of covariant derivative on a discrete lattice. And you see, geometrically, it's very clear what it's doing. So, now, what are gauge transformations? gauge transformation means that at each point, at each vertex I apply an independent transformation. And well, I have some g here, so let me call this h of I, an element of the group. Okay. So this is a gauge transformation. I call it h instead of g because I have already my g, which is a connection. Bad notation. So making a gauge transformation means, as usual, something QED, making a phase transformation on the field. So what is the effect of the gauge transformation H, which is a connection of a collection, let's say, just a collection of independent transformation at each point of the lattice? It means that I transform my field phi into phi H, which is defined such that phi H of I is h of I times phi I. So remember, phi I is a vector in the fundamental transformation, so I can multiply it by an element of the group. And so that I mixed phi 1 and phi 2. That's exactly like the continuum theory. Now, if I have an, what about the covariant derivative? Okay. If I do this transformation on a link that goes from I to G, phi h of I is h of I times phi of I. Phi h of g is h of g times phi of g. And I want the covariant derivative to transform in a covariant way. So, what is dE of phi h? This is phi h of g minus some g of e times phi h of I. So this should be h of g times phi of I minus g of e times g, I'm sorry, h of I times phi of I, and here it's phi of g. Okay. So you see that if you take this definition, it doesn't transform in a covariant way. It depends on the gauge transformation. But if we want this to be of the form h of g times dE of h, I'm sorry, dE of phi h, times h minus 1 of g, which is what we expect, we must change GE. We must make a gauge transformation where G of E goes to GH of E, so that the H of I gets out. So we just want that EGH of E, the solution is H of G, G of E times H minus 1 of I. Okay? And if we do this, this transforms covariantly. Okay. So this is the standard gauge transformation acting on matter field. And this is the gauge transformation acting on the gauge connection. And with this definition, everything is covariant. Okay. So now we have a field where, yes?
In dE of phi h, where does the h minus 1 of I comes from at the end?
Yes. Well, this gives. This gives H of G. Then this phi of G minus G of E. Well, I have. Wait a minute. Yes, no, there is something in my equation which is incorrect because I get, okay, let me be careful. I have h of the phi of g minus h of g of e, h minus 1 of I, h of I, phi of I. So this is h of g. Phi of G minus G of E, phi of I, okay, so this seems to be, so I would like to, oh yes, I know what that is. H minus 1, so I can add H minus 1 of.
Why do we need the h minus 1 of
E? Yeah, I don't think. Yeah, maybe. Oh, yes, that's because we are considering, we are comparing, yes. In some sense, here we are making a distinction between I and G. No. Yeah, so this one is not here. Yeah, I suspected that when I wrote it. Yeah, that's because I'm defining the covariant derivative at G by comparing this transpose. So it's asymmetric between I and G. Yes, you're right. So this covariant derivative is defined at G, and therefore it transforms as a scalar field at G. Yeah. Thank you very much.
So you don't need a subscript H in the last line, right?
Why?
You have Hj, dE, dE phi H, so on the last line.
This one?
Yep. Your phi have a subscript.
Oh, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, again. This was a mistake. This was a typo. Yeah, okay. So this covariant derivative is asymmetric. But you can define the other in the other way and you get. Okay, so you see. Okay. So now, right, so you see, so this is a way to discretize the geometrical degrees of freedom of what is a connection and what is a field on a lattice in a way which has some gauge invariance. Okay. Now, of course, we can, if we want to define a path integral, we must define an action. Okay. So for the matter fields, the action is going to be just the sum of the edge of the square of the covariant derivatives. Now, the problem is what is the action for the gauge, for the connection? So, what is going to be the discretization of the term exponential of minus, well, I'm working in the Euclidean, so minus 1 over g squared times trace of f mu nu. And here again, that's where geometry occurs. F mu nu is basically d mu, well, up to a factor d mu, the connection of d mu and d nu. So it's a curvature. D mu d nu means that you start from a point, you move in the direction mu, then you move in the direction mu, and you compare with what's happening when you are doing this and this. So basically, it tells you how, when you act on some field, if you move it by covariant, by parallel transport, given by the connection, this, and come back here, how the field have transformed. It's a curvature tensor. Okay. So what is the analog? And that's an infinitesimal transformation. So exponential of f corresponds more or less to the exponential or transformation itself. So what is the analog in space-time? This is just that. You take a plaquette. Oh, I'm going too slow, but that's fine. Okay. You take a plaquette, so a square on your square lattice. So let me call it P. It's oriented. Okay, and let's see what corresponds to moving. So it corresponds to move from one point, then to one point, and compose the different transformation. So I'm going to associate an element g of the plaquette. So the plaquette is e1, e2, e3, 4, to the product of these. It's going to be g of e1. Well, in this sense, g of e2, g of e3, g of e4. So the product over the edge belonging to the plaquette, and that's going to be the oriented product of G of E. So this is an element of the group. Okay. And if the connection is trivial, if the element of G are all one, this is going to be one. And if the connection is non-trivial, so if the connection is non-trivial, this is going to be different from one. And if you perform a gauge transformation, like this one, you know, each g minus one here, each h here, is absorbed into the h minus 1 here. So the element of the plaquette, well, g of p is not a nice. Okay. So you see, under a gauge transformation, this is invariant. Closes. Okay. So it's an element of the group which is gauge invariant. So it has the same property of this one. And so, in fact, the solution is that to replace this by, for instance, the trace, and then exponential of integral over P means products. So you can take this by the product of a plaquette of trace of G of the plaquette. And in fact, I think you should take the real part. This, because this is SU2, so this, if you take the real part of the trace of the for a plaquette of P of G of P, will be checked, This is the discrete analog of exponential of minus the Young-Mills action. And if you do this, you can replace the big path integral from the beginning by, if you are on a finite lattice, an integral, a finite integral over copies of SU2 group, of element of SU2 group associated to each element of the group, to each edge. So there are still a huge degeneracy associated to this, but you can define also what is a gauge fixing. For instance, gauge fixing if you are, let's say, if you are in two dimensions, that's especially simple, but gauge fixing in two dimensions means basically fixes all the G here and all the G's here. So that you have only a finite body, for instance, consists in fixing some of the G's on some of the edge. Okay, and finally, I started a bit late, but I wanted to say this because I wanted to say a word about confinement. These products of element that I've defined for a plaquette, a square on the lattice, can be defined, of course, for any curve. So if you have your lattice here, okay, I represent it in two-dimensional, but think about it as four-dimensional. You can consider a curve. It may be quite complicated. It may intersect itself. I have a curve C oriented. And you can define an object which is called W of C, which is at the oriented products over the edges of the curves of the G E, of the G of E. And you can take the trace of this. Let's take the trace of this. Okay. This object is called the Wilson loop. Okay. And it's just the analog in theory of the exponential I times the integral of dA mu, well, of A mu of x dx mu on a curve in continuum space. And for instance, in U1 theory, this is just the famous phase whose integral gives the flux of the magnetic field. This is the flux, electromagnetic flux, and magnetic flux. This is the magnetic flux that flows through a loop. Okay? And this is the phase, this is object is a phase that occurs, for instance, is the Aronoff Bohm effect. Well, there are two British physicists who are also associated to this name, but I forgot today. So this is an object that is known already in classical electromagnetism and quantum mechanics. Okay. So now, I just end up with one word about confinement. If you consider a very large Winston loop, which is very long in one direction, which corresponds to time, where this goes to infinity, and which is large in another direction, L, here.
Which is space.
Okay. And you may be interested in what is the expectation value of this.
In the theory,
in the quantum expectation, in a path integral, compute this object and you sum over all everything. Okay. Well, this is going to be something that basically exponential of minus time times the potential V of L. V of L equal potential between two charges, two classical charges, because this, you see, if you have a Wilson loop, this corresponds to having a particle staying there, an antiparticle staying there, with opposite charges. You consider all the possible charges and you average, but it does, it's symmetric. So this is basically the potential between two charges at distance L. Okay. And then you expect that at short distance, where gauge theory is free, you expect to get something that looks like the Coulomb potential, 1 over L. Okay? V of L is expected to be like 1 over L. Short distance. Okay. Now, Wilson criterion. Confinement. That W of L is linear in L at large distance. And the coefficient in front of L is just called a string tension. Because if you have a system where you have two particles ended up with this L, and when you increase them, the energy is linear with L, it's not a spring, it's not an energy. It's a string. The string model. The initial dual string model that led to superstring theory was a model to describe the interaction between particles in strong interaction. Okay. But if you have a system where, when you have two charged particles, the energy goes linearly with the distance, you can never separate them at infinity because it costs an infinite energy. Okay? There is a constant attraction between the particles, irrespective of the distance. They do not feel the distance. Okay. So this is a Wilson criteria for confinement. And one can study by numerical simulation or analytical studies how this behaves in on lattice gauge theories. And lattice gauge theories, at least a strong coupling, satisfy this criteria. So many of the evidence for confinement comes from lattice gauge theories. And this is a non-perturbative phenomenon, because you can never see this. In perturbation theory, you are just going to see this with logarithmic correction due to the renormalization of the charge. Because here, you are going to have, of course, the charge squared. This is Coulomb or Newton's law. So you can have renormalization of the charge, but they are logarithmic at all order in perturbation theory. Okay? So this ends this course. I'm sorry I've been a bit too long, but I wanted to speak a bit about physics. So thank you very much for all of you who stayed until the end. I see people are missing. And well, it has been a pleasure, very nice experience, especially this year. You have been both nice with me, but also asking a lot of questions and spotting all my typos and mistakes. So I wish you a nice, you know, a good continuation of your year and success in your career. Thank you very much.